It is now my special honor to invite to the podium Gerald Early, a fellow of the American Academy and member of its council, an author, essayist, and cultural critic who has written on topics ranging from prize fighting to jazz to baseball. Well, Gerald is the Merle Kling Professor of Modern Letters at Washington University in St. Louis. Gerald Early.
Edgar Lawrence Doctorow was born and grew up in New York City, a place that is figured prominently in several of his novels. But it must be made clear that he is not a regional writer in the way some think William Kennedy is. Mr. Doctorow thinks of New York, quote, as life, unquote, not as a setting. His first novel was Welcome to Hard Times, a Western, and his second, Big as Life, a science fiction satire. Then he set aside genre fiction. It was with his third novel that he attained considerable critical recognition, The Book of Daniel, published in 1971, inspired by the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. It posed the question, what happened to their son? It was nominated for the National Book Award and is frequently taught in colleges, in college and university literature classes. It was his 1975 novel about race and class in America, Ragtime, that made him a household name, granting him both great critical and commercial success. Ragtime was an innovative historical novel in the spirit of John Dos Passos' USA trilogy, but which took even Dos Passos' far-reaching narrative experiments and bent them like Beckham by blending the early 1900s with the 1960s. Never had a novelist written such a radically experimental novel that was so hugely accessible. Ragtime reverberated across the American literary landscape, and its strong echoes can still be heard in recent novels like Don DeLillo's Underworld, Charles Johnson's Middle Passage, and Russell Banks' Cloud Splitter. Ragtime was adapted as a feature film in 1982 and as a Broadway musical in 1997. Mr. Doctorow's 1989 novel, Billy Bathgate, was another and different experiment with historical and mythological fiction. The story of a young man's immersion in the gangster underworld of the 1930s through his friendship with real-life criminal sociopath Dutch Schultz. This, too, was made into a film, a better one than Ragtime. Mr. Doctorow believes that writers should speak out about the issues in the world. In 1983, he gave a scathing commencement address at Sarah Lawrence denouncing President Ronald Reagan. In 2004, he was heckled during his commencement address at Hofstra when he denounced President Bush. He appeared unbowed by any of the criticism he has received for this. Mr. Doctorow believes, as many of us do, that we pay our taxes in order to ensure the right that we can complain about paying taxes and can complain about what the government does with them. His latest novel is The March, winner of the 2006 Penn Faulkner Award, which is about Sherman's march through Georgia during the Civil War. More than a few observers have considered this historical fiction a commentary on the war in Iraq. Mr. Doctorow isn't saying exactly. Why should he? Novelists should not be asked to explain their novels. The novel is, without question, the most brilliant dramatization of Sherman's march since Margaret Mitchell's searing account in Gone with the Wind. Mr. Doctorow goes far beyond Miss Mitchell in the wholeness of his artistic depiction of the march and what he drew from it, both emotionally and intellectually. I might add that I have personally always been interested in Mr. Doctorow and his works because of his friendship with such African-American novelists as James Baldwin and the shockingly underappreciated John A. Williams. I am grateful that he played a role in publishing them during his time in the 1960s as an editor. Please welcome one of the great American novelists of the last 30 years, E.L. Doctorow.
Thank you for that gracious introduction. So we're going to talk about knowledge as a public good and its importance in a democratic society. You might think that's a no-brainer. But what does it say about the United States today that this fellowship of the arts and sciences and philosophy is called to affirm knowledge as a public good? What have we come to when the self-evident has to be argued as if 500 years into the Enlightenment and 230-some years into the life of this republic, it is a proposition still to be proven? How does it happen that the modernist project that has endowed mankind with the scientific method, the concept of objective evidence, the culture of factuality, responsible for the good and extended life we enjoy in the high-tech world of our freedom, but more important for the history of our species, the means to whatever verified knowledge we have regarding the nature of life and the origins and laws of the universe, how does it happen for reason to have been so deflected and empirical truth to have become so vulnerable to unreason? For some time now, we've been confronted by a religiously inspired criminal movement originated in the Middle East that advertises its values by suicidal bombings, civilian massacres, and the execution of arbitrarily selected victims by the sawing off of their heads. However educated and well-to-do and politically motivated the leaders of this conspiracy may be, they have invoked an extreme fundamentalist reading of their sacred text to mentally transport their rank and file back into the darkness of tribal war and shrieking life contemptuous jihad. So that history, as we look to that part of the world, seems to be running backwards, as if civilization is in reverse, as if time is a loop. And here, the scientists present this evening may have to correct me as I invoke the term quantum non-locality. As I understand the term and make metaphorical use of it, electrons shot from an atom will mirror each other no matter how far apart they are driven, a mile, 10 miles, a hemisphere apart. You look at one and you have a reflection of the other, a kind of weird subatomic dance in celebration of the mimetic proclivities of everything in the universe is quantum non-locality. Now, this is not to suggest that our waterboard and sensory deprivation torture techniques, that Abu Ghraib and the incarceration in perpetuity without trial of terrorist suspects at Guantanamo is the moral equivalent of 9/11. Only that a declared enemy with the mindset of the Dark Ages throws his anachronistic shadow over us and awakens our dormant primeval instincts. Apart from this uncanny synchronous spin, the domestic political fantasy life of these past 7 years finds us in an unnerving time loop of our own making. In this country, quite on its own, history seems to be running in reverse, and knowledge is not seen as a public good, but as something suspect, dubious, or even ungodly, as it was, for example, in Italy in 1633 when the church put Galileo on trial for his heretical view that the earth is in orbit around the sun. Now, I'm not a scientist, and I don't deal in formulas, but as a writer, I would, in the words of Henry James, quote, take to myself the faintest hints of life and convert the very pulses of the air into revelations, close quote. And that surely provides me with a line to unreason. And so when I read that the president of Iran denies the historical truth of the Holocaust And when I hear the President of the United States rejecting the scientific truth of global warming, I recognize that no matter whatever distance they would keep between them, and whatever their confrontational stance, they are fellow travelers in the nether world. Two things must be said about knowledge deniers. Their rationale is always political, and more often than not, they hold in their hand a sacred text for certification. But you may say, am I not narrowing this issue, politicizing it by speaking of our president? In this discussion of knowledge as a foundation for a democratic society, am I not misusing this forum to broadcast a partisan point of view? Well, Albert Einstein once said that even the most perfectly planned democratic institutions are no better than the people whose instruments they are. I would translate that remark this way: the president we get is the country we get. With each elected president, the nation is conformed spiritually. He's the artificer of our malleable national soul. He proposes not only the laws, but the kinds of lawlessness that govern our lives and invoke our responses. The people he appoints are cast in his image. The trouble they get into and get us into is his characteristic trouble. And finally, the media amplify his character into our moral weather report. He becomes the face of our sky, the conditions that prevail. From those fundamentalist leaders who proclaim 9/11 as our just deserts for our secular humanism, our civil libertarianism, our feminists, our gay and lesbian citizens, our abortion providers, and in so doing honored the foreign killers of nearly 3,000 Americans as agents of God's justice, to the creationists, the biblical literalists, the anti-Darwinian school boards, the right to life for anti-abortionist activists, the shrill media ideologues whose jingoist patriotism and ad hominem ranting serve for public discourse, all of it in degradation of the thinking mind, all of it in fear of what it knows. These phenomena are summoned up and enshrined by presidential policies, who at the same time has set the national legislative program to run in reverse as he rescinds, deregulates, dismantles, or otherwise degrades enlightened legislation clearly in the public interest. And in the meantime, great national needs in healthcare, in education, in disaster relief go unmet, so that in sum, we find ourselves living in a social psychic structure of the ghostly past. It will take more than the recent congressional elections and revelations of an inveterately corrupt administration to dissolve the miasma of otherworldly weirdness hanging over this land, to recover us from our spiritual disarray, to regain our once clear national sense of ourselves, however illusory, as the last best hope of mankind. With our once upright democratic posture bent and misshapen, what rough beast are we as we slouch toward Bethlehem? What are we become in the hands of this president with his relentless subversion of our right to know? His unfounded phantasmal justifications for going to war, his signing away of laws passed by Congress that he doesn't like, his unlawful secret surveillance of Americans, our phone records, our email, his dicta time again in presumption of total executive supremacy over the other two branches of government, his insensitivity to the principle of separation of church and state, his obsessive secrecy, his covert policies of torture and extraordinary rendition, where the courtroom testimony of the tortured on the torture they've endured at our hands is disallowed on the grounds that our torture techniques are classified. His embargoing of past presidential papers and impeding access of documents to investigatory bodies, his use of the Justice Department to bring indictments or quash them as his party's electoral interests demand, knowledge sealed, skewed, sequestered, shouted down, the bearers of knowledge fired or smeared, knowledge edited, sneered at, shredded, and as in the case of the coffins of our dead military brought home at night, no photography allowed, knowledge spirited away in the dark. Now, I realize that with these remarks, I may be violating the linguistic proprieties of an academic convocation. I realize in the tenor of these times that anyone who speaks of the broad front of failure and mendacity and carelessness of human life in so much of our public policy in tones any louder than muted regret is usually marginalized as some sort of radical, that is, someone out of the mainstream and not to be taken seriously. But I believe what I have described so far is not a personal condemnation of an individual, but an accurate and knowledgeable account of the present state of the Union. We must ask if the rage to deconstruct our Constitution and Bill of Rights has any connection with the prevalence of God in the mind of this worshipful president. We must ask to what extent and however unconscious a level a conflict arises in the pious political mind when it is sworn to uphold the civil religion of the Constitution. The idea of the United States may have had its sources in the European Enlightenment, but it was the actions taken by self-declared Americans that brought it into focus and established it as an entity. America is a society evolved from words written down on paper by ordinary mortals, however extraordinary they happen to be as human beings. When constitutional scholars speak of the American civil religion, they recognize that along with its separation of church and state, our Constitution and its amendments establishes as civil law ethical presumptions common to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But if you have extracted the basic ethics of religious invention and found the mechanism for installing them in the statutes of the secular civic order, but have consigned all the doctrine and rite and ritual, all the symbols and traditional practices to the precincts of private life, you are saying there is no one proven path to salvation. There are only traditions. If you relegate the old stories to the personal choices of private worship, you admit the ineffable is ineffable, and in terms of a possible theological triumphalism, everything is up for grabs. Our pluralism cannot be entirely comfortable to someone of evangelical faith. But to the extreme fundamentalist, that member of the evangelical community militant in his belief, an absolutist intolerant of all forms of belief but his own, all stories but his own, our pluralism has to be a profound offense. I speak of the so-called political base with which our president has bonded. In our raucous democracy, fundamentalist religious belief has organized itself with political acumen to promulgate law that would undermine just those secular humanist principles that encourage it to flourish in freedom. Of course, there has rarely been a period in our history when God has not been called upon to march. Northern abolitionists and Southern slave owners both claim biblical endorsement. Martin Luther King's civil rights movement drew its strength from prayer and examples of Christian fortitude, while the Ku Klux Klan invoked Jesus as a sponsor of their racism. But there is a crucial difference between these traditional invocations and the politically astute and well-funded activists of today's Christian right, who do not call upon their faith to certify their politics as much as they call for a country that certifies their faith. Fundamentalism really cannot help itself. It is absolutist and can compromise with nothing, not even democracy. Now, I value the point of view of Professor Mark Knoll. I didn't have the privilege of hearing the panel in which he spoke this morning, but I had the written record of his comments. And he spoke of the historical merger of the forces of traditional Christianity with the forces of enlightenment. And it's a serious misreading, he says, of American history to portray the tangled cultural and political conflicts of our time as pitting the pre-critical hordes of religion against the hypercritical avatars of science. Historically, there has tended to be a religious accommodation of science. In the 19th century, he says, American theological conservatives could also be Darwinists. And even in the strident debates of today, fundamentalists still proclaim their allegiance to facts as loudly as their opponents. And theories such as intelligent design and creation science implicitly accept the modern scientific consensus on evolution while maintaining a confident belief in the traditional deity. According to Professor Knoll, and I accept all that, but all contrarian movements, like revolutions, devolve to their extremist expression, do they not? The theorists of creation science and intelligent design have marching on their right flank, with or without their approval, if not pre-critical hordes of religion, a militantly censorious, well-funded political movement that a president of the United States has tapped into for his and their benefit. I'm not aware that American history, so invoked by Professor Knoll, has a precedent for this. Nor am I aware that the hypercritical avatars of the secular scientific method have an equivalent hard-nosed political organization behind them. They don't even have a marching band. The president has said that the war with terrorists will last for decades and is a confrontation between good and evil. Whether he means the evil of specific terrorist organizations or the culture from which they spring, his vision is necessarily Manichaean, and there is immense political power in such religiously inspired reductionism. Thus, no matter what the reasons might be for his invasion of Iraq, and they keep changing, or how badly has it gone, bumblingly and tragically ruinous, so many lives destroyed. And no matter how many thousands of terrorists this has brought into being, to criticize his policy or the architects of it is said to aid the enemy. Presidents in a circle of advisors who conspire in this Manichaean worldview have the unnatural vividness in my mind, the unnatural vividness of personality of Shakespearean plotters. While the original think tank theorists and proponents of the war have quietly and understandably withdrawn from public view, the vice president, the president's chief policy advisor, stand tall, the first contemptuous of his critics, his denials of reality and obfuscations delivered in the dour tones of unquestionable authority. In the second, because he has spent his years developing a theocratic constituency and wearing such blinders as an exclusive concern with party power has attached to him, most clearly has a future in the culture of anti-democracy he has so deviously and unwisely nurtured. Manichaean politics reduces the relevance of knowledge and degrades the truth which knowledge discovers. The past 7 years of American political life are an uncanny cycle we've slipped into or slid into that foresees the democratic traditions of this country as too much of a luxury to be maintained. We see since the last election the struggle now for the legislative branches to regain some of its constitutional prerogatives. They struggle not only with a recalcitrant president and a vice president who impugns their motives, but against the presidents of the imperial presidencies of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, each of whom added another conservative shock to to the principle of separation of powers. Many of the executive practices today, the blatant cronyism, the political use of the Justice Department, were empowered by these precedents, and so we have marched along from the imperial presidency through 4 years of a one-party faux democracy to plutocracy, to the borders of authoritarianism. To take the long view, American politics may be seen as a struggle between the idealistic secular democracy of a fearlessly self-renewing America, the metaphysical risks that are the heritage of the Enlightenment, and our great resonant capacity to be in denial of what is intellectually and morally incumbent upon us to pursue. Melville in Moby Dick speaks of reality outracing apprehension. Apprehension in the sense not of fear or disquiet, but of understanding. Reality is too much for us to take in, as for example, the white whale is too much for the Pequod and its captain. It may be that our new century is an awesome, complex whale in our quantumized wave particles and the manipulable stem cells of our biology, and ecologically in our planetary crises of nature, and technologically in our humanoid molecular computers, and sexually in the rising number of our genders, and intellectually in the paradoxes of our texts, and so on. So what is more natural than to rely on the saving powers of simplism? Perhaps with our dismal public conduct so shot through with piety, we are actually engaged in a genetic engineering venture that will make a slower, dumber, more sluggish whale. One that can be harpooned and flensed, tried and boiled to light our candles. A kind of water wonderworld whale made of racism, nativism, cultural illiteracy, fundamentalist fantasy, and the righteous priorities of wealth. I summon up the year 1787, when the Constitutional Convention had done its work and the drafted Constitution was sent out to the states for ratification. The public's excitement was palpable. Extended and vigorous state house debates echoed through the towns and villages. And as one by one the states voted to ratify, church bells rang, cheers went up from the public houses, and in the major cities the people turned out to parade with a fresh new sense of themselves as a nation. Everyone marched, tradespeople, working men, soldiers, women, clergy, children. They had floats in those days, most often a wagon-sized ship of state called the Union, rolling through the streets with children waving from the scuppers. Philadelphia came up with a float called the New Roof, a dome supported by 13 pillars and ornamented with stars. It was drawn by 10 white horses, and at the top was a handsome cupola surmounted by a figure of plenty bearing her cornucopia. The ratification parades were sacramental, symbolic venerations, acts of faith. From the beginning, people saw the Constitution as a kind of sacred text for a civil society, and with good reason. The ordaining voice of the Constitution is scriptural, but in resolutely keeping the authority for its dominion in the public consent, it presents itself as the sacred text of secular humanism. When the ancient Hebrews broke their covenant, they suffered a loss of identity and brought disaster on themselves. Our burden, too, is covenantal. We may point to our 200 some years of national survival as an open society, constitutionally sworn to a degree of free imaginative expression that few cultures in the world can tolerate. We may regard ourselves as an exceptionalist, historically self-correcting nation whose democratic values locate us just as surely as our geography. And yet we know at the same time that all through our history, we have brutally excluded vast numbers of us from the shelter of the new roof. We have broken our covenant again and again with virtuosity verging on damnation, and have been saved only by the sacrificial efforts of constitution-reverencing patriots in and out of government, presidents, senators, justices, self-impoverishing lawyers, abolitionists, muckrakers, third-party candidates, suffragists, union organizers, striking workers, civil rights martyrs. Because this president's subversion of the Constitution outdoes anything that has gone on before, and as it has created large social constituencies ready to support the flag-waving ideals of an incremental fascism, we're called upon to step forward to reaffirm our covenant like these exemplars from the past. The philosopher Richard Rorty has suggested in his book, Achieving the Country, Achieving Our Country, that the metaphysic of American civil religion is pragmatism, and its prophets are Walt Whitman and John Dewey. The most striking feature of their redescription of our country, says Rorty, is its thoroughgoing secularism. The moral they draw from the European past, and in particular from Christianity, is not instruction about the authority under which we should live, but suggestions about how to make ourselves wonderfully different from anything that has been. I add to that that to temporize human affairs, to look up, to look not up for some applied celestial accreditation, but forward on ground level in the endless journey to resist any authoritarian restrictions on thought, suppression of knowledge that is the public good, is the essence of our civil religion. It is Whitman, our great poet and pragmatic philosopher, who advises us not to be curious about God, but to affix our curiosity to our own lives and the earth we live on, and then perhaps as far as we can see into the universe with our telescopes. This was the charge he gave himself, and it is the source of all the intent of love in his poetry. If we accept it as our own and decide something is right after all in a democracy that is given to a degree of free imaginative expression that few cultures in the world can tolerate, we can hope for the aroused witness, the manifold reportage, the flourishing of knowledge that will restore us to ourselves, awaken the dull sense of our people to the public interest that is their interest, and vindicate the genius of the humanist sacred text that embraces us all. Thank you very much.
The American Academy, past Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, University Professor, Emma Ann McLaughlin Metcalf Professor of the Humanities, and Professor of English and Modern Foreign Languages and Literature at Boston University, Rosanna Warren.
We'll hear again from Walt Whitman. This is section 5 from Song of Myself, the least self-centered of works, because Whitman's self contains multitudes. It has one bizarre word, kelson, which most of you probably know means the longitudinal beam along the keel of a ship that holds all the planks together. I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. Loaf with me on the grass, loose the stop from your throat, not words, not music or rhyme I want, not custom or lecture, not even the best, only the lull I like, the hum of your velvet voice. I mind how once we lay such a transparent summer morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me, and parted my shirt from my bosom bone, and plunged your tongue to my bare-stripped heart, and reached till you felt my beard, and reached till you held my feet. Swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that pass all the arguments of the earth, and I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own, and I know that the Spirit of God is the brother of my own, and that all men ever born are also my brothers, and the women my sisters and lovers, and that a kelson of the creation is love, and limitless are leaves stiff or drooping in the fields, and brown ants in the little wells beneath them, and mossy scabs of the worm fence, heaped stones, elder, mullein, and pokeweed. I'm reading the proem to Hart Crane's great flawed visionary epic, The Bridge, a poem that gives a dream of our country as a mystic unity, a country that we might think is also a great flawed visionary epic. Proem to Brooklyn Bridge. How many dawns chill from his rippling rest, the seagull's wings shall dip and pivot him, shedding white rings of tumult, building high over the chained bay waters liberty. Then, with inviolate curve, forsake our eyes as apparitional as sails that cross some page of figures to be filed away till elevators drop us from our day. I think of cinema's panoramic slights and multitudes bent towards some flashing scene never disclosed, but hastened to again, foretold to other eyes on the same screen. And thee, across the harbor, silver-paced, as though the sun took step of thee, yet left some motion ever unspent in thy stride, implicitly thy freedom staying thee. Out of some subway scuttle, cell, or loft, a bedlamite speeds to thy parapets, tilting there momently, shrill shirt ballooning, a jest falls from the speechless caravan. Down wall, from girder into street, noon leaks, a rip tooth of the skies acetylene. All afternoon the cloud-flown derricks turn, thy cables breathe the North Atlantic still. And obscure as that heaven of the Jews, thy guerdon, accolade thou dost bestow of anonymity time cannot raise, vibrant reprieve and pardon thou dost show. O harp and altar of the fury fused, how could mere toil align thy quiring strings? Terrific threshold of the prophet's pledge, prayer of pariah and the lover's cry. Again, the traffic lights that skim thy swift, unfractioned idiom, immaculate sigh of stars beading thy path, condense eternity, and we have seen night lifted in thine arms. Under thy shadow by the piers I waited, only in shadow, only in darkness is thy shadow clear, the city's fiery parcels all undone, already snow submerges and iron year. Oh, sleepless as the river under thee, vaulting the sea, the prairie's dreaming sod, unto us lowliest, sometime sweep, descend, and of the curve ship lend a myth to God. In this poem, Locus, one of America's master poets, Robert Hayden, addresses one of America's master fiction writers, Ralph Ellison. The title, Locus, means place, and we could take the place in the poem to be the American South And we could take it to be the whole United States, tragically conceived. Locus for Ralph. Here, red buds like momentary trees of an illusionist. Here, Cherokee rose, acacia, and mimosa. Here, magnolias, totemic flowers, wreathing legends of this place. Here, violent metamorphosis, with every blossom turning deadly, and memorial soldiers, their sabers drawn, charging firewood shacks, apartheid streets. Here, wound red earth and blinding cotton fields, rock hills where sachems counseled, where scouts gazed stealthily upon the glittering death march of DeSoto through Indian wilderness. Here, mockingbird and cottonmouth, fury of rivers. Here, swamp and trace and bayou where the runagate hid, the devil with Spanish pistols rode. Here, spareness, rankness, harsh brilliances, beauty of what's hard-bitten, knotted, stinted, flourishing in despite, on thorny meagerness thriving, twisting into grace. Here, symbol houses, where the brutal dream lives out its lengthy dying. Here, the past, adored and unforgiven. Here, the past, soulscape, Old Testament battleground of warring shades whose weapons kill.